going to call the committee to order, although we do not have a quorum. We're going to go ahead and get started. We have a lot of work to cover today. We want to hear from all of the folks who've taken time to come again today, some of them for a second time. And we're going to start, though, with the topic of discussion that deals with the recommendations from the U.S. Prevention Service Task Force on Mammography. And we've asked the Minnesota Department of Health to come and talk with us about how they are implementing that recommendation and what their thoughts are about that. So it's been one that's had quite a bit of discussion publicly, and we thought maybe we better make sure we got good factual information out there. So Ms. Manning and Simon, okay, welcome to the committee, and if you'd introduce yourself, please.
Madam Chair, committee, my name is Mary Manning. I'm with the Minnesota Department of Health. I'm the Director of Health Promotion and Chronic Disease. And with me, Shelley, you want to introduce yourself?
My name is Shelley Madigan. I am the SAGE Screening Program Director.
Welcome.
Madam Chair, more than 620 breast cancer deaths occur annually in Minnesota. A substantial proportion of these deaths are preventable. Every year in Minnesota, 3,500 women are diagnosed with breast cancer. Our SAGE program at the Minnesota Department of Health helps to decrease the number of Minnesotans who die from these cancers through our screening programs. In our program, women age 40 and older, we recommend get mammograms every 1 to 2 years. Mammography saves lives because it can find breast cancer early. And the earlier women find the cancer, the better. When cancer is found early, almost 98% of the women survive 5 years later. In Minnesota, we also believe that no woman should die from cervical cancer, yet every year in Minnesota, there are 170 women who are diagnosed with cervical cancer, and 45 women die of this disease. If a woman can't afford a mammogram or a PAP in Minnesota, the SAGE program does provide services for low-income women with inadequate insurance or without insurance. We have detected over 1,400 breast cancers and 57 cervical cancers through SAGE. Last year, we helped 18,200 women over that get free mammograms and PAP tests. More than 32% of the women that are served by the SAGE program are women of color. 62% of all those women had no health insurance, and 22% of them actually reported that they had never had a mammogram. The SAGE program, along with the American Cancer Society, continues to recommend that women age 40 and older should have screening every year and should continue to do so as long as they're in good health. Current evidence supporting mammograms is even stronger than it's been in the past. Recent evidence has confirmed that mammograms offer substantial benefits to women over 40. Women can feel confident about these benefits. However, mammograms do have their limitations, and it will miss some cancers, and sometimes it will lead to findings that need follow-up and biopsies. Women should be told about these benefits and limitations, and we contract with physicians and providers that do so. They should be told about the harms linked with regular screening, that some cancers may be missed, and that there are some limitations, but this is a very effective tool and very valuable for decreasing death and suffering from cancer. The U.S. Preventive Task Force recommendations this last November was reviewing old data and expressing concerns that mammograms lead to added tests due to the suspicion of cancer, and that these added tests ultimately sometimes prove to be negative. And the younger the woman is, the more frequently this occurs and adds unnecessary costs. But we believe, as does the American Cancer Society, and the program gets a majority of its funding from the CDC, that we still recommend that women 40 and older still receive mammography every year, and that it's very important strategy to helping decrease the death rate from breast cancer, a preventable death. That's what I have to say.
Okay, and Ms. Madigan, did you have anything to add?
No, Mary has covered it.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Well, I'm just wondering, what do you make of the recommendations that under, that between 40 and 49, that it's really, you're just adding ionizing radiation without really the evidence that it produces additional information that really is helpful? I mean, what do you make of the science that was put forward in the national study? Is it, you mentioned something about the date of the...
November of this, I guess that was 2009. Madam Chair, committee, the controversy was really over the false negatives. It wasn't related to the amount of ionizing radiation that was women were exposed to unnecessarily. That was not the issue in the preventative task force. The issue was the stress and the emotional strain that having false positives that needed biopsy and further evaluation had on younger women may not be worth the cost. That was what the controversy centered around, not the amount of radiation women were exposed to at a younger age.
And if I could add to that, cancers, any screening program and any screening test is going to have false positives. And heart disease, when we do electrocardiograms, they have significant number of false positives, but we don't say not to screen for heart disease. And if I may add a personal note, both Mary and I had breast cancer detected in our 40s. Mine was detected through mammogram, Mary's was not. And we would not be here today if we did not have those health-saving screening tests, and we neither one of us had a family history either, and so you don't know. And so the real recommendation that we have for younger women in their 40s is to have a dialogue with their physician and to decide based on their personal history and their general health whether or not they should get mammography.
Madam Chair, can I also just mention one thing about
Ms. Manning.
Thank you. About Shelley's comment, both Shelley and I were involved with this program beforehand too, so it wasn't, we didn't come to this program as breast cancer survivors. We just joined the ranks while we were working with this program.
Okay, and can you talk a little bit more about what the risks are from mammography? I mean, they did talk about that somewhat. It's not totally innocuous.
They said, Madam Chair, the risks that they addressed in the U.S. Preventive Task Force had to do with the amount of false positives that women were needing additional testing to confirm whether or not additional biopsy and testing to see if women actually had breast cancer, and the stress and the cost related to that. I have read the U.S. Task Force. I don't remember at all seeing any issue related to ionizing radiation, but I'm not a scientist. But that overall, the concern had to do with the amount of false positives that would need further follow-up.
Well, I do have, and when the committee does have the document in front of them, and there is mention of radiation exposure, although a minor concern is also a consideration, is their language. So they do have it as one of the considerations. And I know that there have been a number of breast cancer advocacy groups out there that have been actually raising that issue more and more to try to, you know, really have the discussion whether or not it is advisable to have women between the ages, particularly 40 and 49, premenopausal women, supposedly mostly. I think it's a 12 times more incidence of false positives, which is not a small number. And that's a big concern. And I wanted this committee just to have the opportunity to think about this, because I thought that the discussion, public discussion, has been so confusing, I think, to some folks. Did you care to comment?
I would, Madam Chair. Thank you. The leading advocate of the groups that you're talking about is the National Breast Cancer Coalition. And what they prefer the money be spent on is finding a cure. It's not that they don't advocate women having mammography. So they are very much in sync with the American Cancer Society recommendations that women have a dialogue with their physician and determine whether or not it's appropriate for them to have mammography screening.
Okay. That actually was, that's one of the groups I was thinking about, and probably some of the groups within there, too, that are urging the kind of thing you're talking about, to have individual considerations. You've got to look at family history and all of that. And I think in your own demonstration up there, it was a 50% breakdown of whether the if I understood what you described, whether in your instance of the two of you there, which whether or not the mammogram was what made the difference or not. Is that, and that's what I think I heard you say, right? One person yes and the other one no. And I think it's just important that our state policy, I think, reflect the thoughtfulness that I thought was in the report. It seemed like it was just really blown out of proportion in some ways, and I want to make sure that our, you know, that we help bring forward the discussion, at least that people know there's choices and there's differences of opinion, and we need to know what our state policy is.
Madam Chair, I agree with you. And one of the other pieces of discussion that we've had, both with the CDC and the American Cancer Society, and one of the other things that balance on this is women who get breast cancer in their 40s also often have a more aggressive form of breast cancer. And that's another thing that's weighing in on the side for many of the people, the American Cancer Society, the CDC, and other advocacy groups for breast cancer is, and another reason why they're weighing in to continue getting screening for women 40 to 50.
Okay, thank you.
Madam Chair, one more thing if I could say.
Yes, please, Mrs. Mandekin.
The SAGE program is available in every county in the state of Minnesota. We have over 430 providers. Women can access it close to where they live, and we do pay for a clinical visit, so it gives them an opportunity to have that discussion with their physician and best serve their needs and interests. So we hope that we are doing what is best for women and providing the health providers an opportunity to better serve the women in their communities who otherwise wouldn't get these tests.
All right. Thank you. And I think, you know, this committee has supported the SAGE program, and we're glad that you're still being funded in the current round. And I guess one final question I'd have is, because the issue of radiation is raised in that document, and because it's been raised in a lot of the discussions that have been happening with the advocates who are, you know, very much concerned about breast cancer, I'm just wondering, is our Department of Health looking at the issue of radiation in terms of diagnostics, not just with mammography, but, you know, there have been quite a bit of discussions recently, at least in the public arena, about overexposure in everything from heart exams on numerous, especially if you're a cancer survivor, you're asked to have numerous exposures. I can tell you that myself. Is there more discussion about, you know, helping the public be informed about the limits of diagnostic radiation and its relationship to actually cancer, but also other issues?
Madam Chair, Assistant Commissioner John Stein can come up here and address that question for you.
All right. Thank you. Okay. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Stein.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is John Stein, Assistant Commissioner for Health Protection at the Department of Health. To the question you raised regarding the effects of ionizing radiation and what the Department of Health's current efforts are, I can respond that you may be aware that we license and inspect all X-ray operations at licensed facilities around the state. So that would include dental offices, chiropractor's offices, hospitals, and healthcare clinics. Our job in that is to assure that the equipment operates within established parameters that are identified by federal agencies for safe operations. We do that to assure that people are not overexposed to radiation, ionizing radiation, during their tests, both for chest X-rays, for all forms of radiation. We also under contract with the Food and Drug Administration, carry out the certification of mammography equipment. Those are not licensed by the state. Those are federally regulated, and we do the inspections of that equipment for the Federal Food and Drug Administration. Lastly, we look at radioactive materials, and so any radioactive materials that are used in cancer therapy or in other medical therapies or experimental research activities at academic institutions, all of that radioactive materials licensing is a part of our Department of Health's agreement with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. We actually license and assure the safe use and transport and retention of those ionizing materials. So the department has a significant amount of work going on in licensing and regulation of the equipment. We no longer have staff resources to provide general consultation to the public related to ionizing radiation. That was something we looked at. I know we did some of that work in the 70s and 80s with electromagnetic fields associated with concerns over power line extensions, and as cell phones were coming onto the scene and people were concerned about electromagnetic fields and radiation that could be ascribed to cell phones and cell towers, that we did some work on that. We no longer have the staff to carry out that kind of advice and consultation for the public.
And there's a couple other questions from others. I just want to ask you a question about the issue of, and I don't know that there's any tracking of this, but, you know, cumulative exposure to ionizing radiation is really the danger. You know, an x-ray from a dentist here and, you know, a follow-up exam somewhere else might begin to raise some issues, but the cumulative impact is something I don't think there's too much question about. And I don't know that we're in any way following that. And one of the reasons I really thought this was important, you know, as we look at what they're proposing at some of the airports and other places where there's whole body exposures, different kinds of ways of looking at the exposure of the body to various kinds of electromagnetic or x-rays, I think it's important that we have people in our public health system at least raising the issue. And I'm just wondering if you are looking at that at all.
Madam Chair, we follow the literature, but we don't have any ongoing investigations or work on that. Certainly what we know in our work with the professionals that are exposed on a regular basis because of their work, because they are an x-ray technician, they are employee of a nuclear power generating plant, they are a dental office x-ray technician. Those folks are required under their occupational safety requirements to wear dosimeters, a monitor that measures the amount of radiation that they're exposed to, and they are those are tracked as part of the Occupational Safety and Health Administration's requirements. One of the things that we do not investigate with any regularity is sort of that cumulative radiation exposure. To the best of our knowledge, according to the sources that we've read, there's people's cumulative exposures are generally at much lower levels than what would be considered occupational exposures that are defined as a safe level. So people's exposure to radiation in a cumulative sense that are going to the dentist, going to the doctor, going through the airport screening, probably at a much lower level. But your question about, are we looking at that? Are we trying to identify what the total, you know, amount of ionizing radiation people are exposed to? We're not currently doing that.
Representative Benson, I believe you had a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm looking at the last bullet point on the U.S. Task Force mammography screening recommendations. I'm just wondering if one or more of the testifiers could expand on this recommendation. It says women should not be taught breast self-examination, and what your take is on that recommendation. Why is that on there, and what's your take on it?
Madam Chair. Thank you. Breast self-exam has not proven to find breast cancers early enough. Mammography can find breast cancers at least 2 years earlier than breast self-exam. And breast self-exam has led to a lot of false assurances for women, because if they think that they are doing the breast self-exam correctly and they miss a breast cancer, they are coming into the doctor at a time when the cancer is so advanced that it is difficult to treat it and have the survival rates that we find with mammography.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Huntley? Oh, no? Okay. Representative Bly?
Thank you, Chair Clark. I had a question for the Department of Health representative, and it was alarming to me, or concerned me, when you mentioned that you don't have the staff to do some of these inspections, and I guess I'm wondering how critical an exercise is this to be checking into and equipment or whatever that you're no longer able to do, and I'm wondering, did you ever have the staff to do these things, and at what time has that changed, and go ahead.
Madam Chair, Representative Bly, we do have staff. I don't want to mislead you. We do have staff to do equipment inspections. We inspect X-ray equipment on a rotating cycle around the state. So that we are funded through fees that the licensees contribute. So that is fully compliant with the law. There's a schedule prescribed by the law for X-ray equipment inspection for the tracking and monitoring of radioactive materials and so forth. What we are no longer providing is sort of a general consultation to the public about radiation exposures. So there's not a department generalist or radiation person who's assigned to respond to general public phone calls, that sort of thing. That was something that we did in days when we had a higher allocation of federal preventive block grant dollars for the CDC. Those dollars have been declining for about the last decade. We used some preventive block grant dollars for that function. We also had some general fund dollars that were higher in the past that allowed us to partner up some of our air quality advice on outdoor air exposures to fine particulate matter, wood smoke, those sorts of things, and radiation and some other more general environmental health concerns that people might have. So those functions, I would say, have been decreasing, but have really come to a stop in about the last, about 5 years ago.
Representative Bly.
Thank you, Chair Clark. Just in an offhand conversation with one of my constituents, she described having worked in a lab that did radiating of foods and things like that and described to me a situation at times where sometimes the equipment might stick or whatever, and
right.
there were, I mean, normally it worked, but there was an occasion when they weren't sure, and they do wear these little tags that tell them if they're getting too much radiation. But she said sometimes they would have to sort of draw straws to see who would go in and check out the equipment, and that's someone has to do it. But those kind of concerns are alarming to me, and I just want to make sure that things are being taken care of.
Madam Chair, Representative Bly, yes, the occupational safety and health concerns are administered through OSHA and through the Minnesota Occupational Safety and Health Administration. And so radiation specialists, X-ray technologists, so forth, are trained in calibrating the equipment. That's their one of their primary jobs, is to make sure that the equipment does not malfunction and overdose people with radiation. And we then do our inspection processes to make sure that they have kept the records. Every time they calibrate that equipment, they are required to document the equipment's operating range and when it may have malfunctioned, and that all of that information is tracked. So that's part of our routine inspection process. In terms of the dosimeters, those little badges that people wear, yes, they do sometimes need to rotate, because your daily and your annual dose that you're exposed to for radiation is strongly controlled by the Occupational Safety and Health Administration. So That's true for everyone who's got an occupation where they're routinely exposed to ionizing radiation.
Mr. Stein, just in that regard, you say it's strongly controlled. So over a year's exposure could disqualify a person from continuing to work in a...
Madam Chair, that's correct. If their dose were ever to be exceeded, they would then be excluded from that activity that would be increasing their dose.
Be interesting to see how often that does or does not happen. I'm curious, do you track that at all?
Madam Chair, we do not. That would be an Occupational Safety and Health Administration
Representative
requirement.
Representative Benson?
Just to follow up on that, Madam Chair, thank you. In testimony last session, we heard that OSHA's personnel is so stretched that they do not inspect manufacturing plants and others sometimes for years on end. What's the record as far as OSHA is concerned with your organization? You're saying they're tightly controlled. Are they really with so few OSHA inspectors?
Madam Chair, Representative Benson, I really don't know the answer to that question, how frequently they're able to get out to site visits and so forth. That would be a question for them. But I do know that my comment regarding the tight control is the regulation is very specific, would be more accurately the way to say that. There is a specific limit to which anyone who works with ionizing radiation is not to be exceeded, and that's what the dosimeters they wear are for, is to assure that they are not... Our employees wear dosimeters because of their regular exposure to ionizing radiation. So we take it very seriously at the Department of Health. I can't answer your question, however, regarding the OSHA rates of inspection and compliance, their staffing. That would be a question for them. I'm sorry.
Thank you. I know we're going to have to move on. Is it okay? Okay. Just two quick things. We are passing around Christine, honored us all with more brownies today. So thanks, Christine. and our guests, if you wait there for a second, that'll get down to the end of the table, and you certainly can have some. I just did want to ask you, of the groups that we're looking over today in terms of their ability to do their work, are any of those folks involved in the monitoring, or the medical practice, or any of the parts of the health department, or outside of the health department? Maybe you don't know, and I can ask them, I guess.
I'm not sure, Madam Chair. Okay. I apologize.
That's right. We'll ask as we go along. Any other questions from committee members? If not, Representative McNamara, help yourself. Those were a gift from Christine. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Let's go forward with the board reviews. And the next one I have listed is marriage and family therapy, Robert Butler, and then medical practice. After that, nursing, then nursing home administrators, then psychology, then physical therapy, podiatric medicine, then social work, and family ombudsman, and finally, if we have time, the Disability Council. And members, so let's try to make sure we can get through this group of folks. Jake is advising me that if we can hold your comments to about 5 minutes for each person, we should be able to get through this list today. So go ahead and present your information. We do want to hear, I think if you were here yesterday, thank you for coming back.
My name is Julie Bangsness, and I'm with the Administrative Services Unit. I'm here on behalf of the Board of Marriage and Family Therapy. Robert Butler was unable to attend, and I'd like to just briefly go over his proposed budget cuts that are included in the governor's budget. This board has about 1,300 licensees, and their budget cut is proposed to be $2,000 in fiscal year 10 and $4,000 in fiscal year 11. They have a base budget of $137,000, and they bring in about $261,000 in their total revenue. These cuts will affect the board by reducing the amount of funds that will be available for expert witnesses when complaints come in, also reducing the cost that we pay currently to the board members for reimbursement and travel, and then shifting currently the online processing fees when licensees renew online. The board has been paying for those, and we would have to shift those back out to the licensee to balance the budget here. This board already has a budget issue. We had submitted a $22,000 base increase that was not included in the governor's budget, so that's going to require us to make some drastic cuts within the board and also look at possibly reducing its current 1.6 FTEs to maintain within the current base budget. Do you have any questions?
Questions from committee members? I just want one question about their limiting of expert witnesses. Is this in a situation where there is a contested or a complaint that you're dealing with, or at what point are you referring to that?
Madam Chair, right now what it would do is cut the available funds that we have available if a complaint came in and arise to that situation. It would limit how much funds we do have available and how many contested or expert witnesses we would be able to hire to help assess that. We'd probably have to rely on board members and staff and only move forward on the more difficult cases.
I think one of the things this committee is interested in is, what are we talking about here? What would be an example, and is it a, are we, who are we jeopardizing here by not having adequate staff?
Madam Chair, I'm unable to really answer that question.
Okay.
I can have the executive director respond to you in writing.
That's fine. Thank you very much. I think it's just helpful to know, what do these boards do? What are some of the problems that you're solving and that you may not be able to help us solve? All right. Thank you very much. No further questions. We'll go to the medical practice. Is Mr. Leach here?
He is not here. And
okay.
I can go over the financial numbers of his budget.
Okay.
I would not have policy type answers.
I see. Okay. Do we expect him, or was he not able to come back?
Madam Chair, he may be able to come back toward the end.
Okay.
He's at another meeting, so if we
wanted
to
just
put
hold
him
off on
to
that
the
one.
End,
we'll
that
hold
would
off
be
on
great.
That. Thank you. Then we'll go on nursing. Shirley Brecken. And I thank you for coming back. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for allowing us to present this information to you. There are over, the Board of Nursing regulates a little over 105,000 registered nurses and LPNs and about 5,000 advanced practice registered nurses. This is a significant change for us over the last 8 years. We've experienced a 25% increase in the number of licensees. And of course, as a result of that, a 25% increase in the number of complaints that we handle. In fact, last year the board dealt with about 1,450 written jurisdictional complaints. We've also experienced a 33% increase in the number of schools of nursing. One of the functions of the Board of Nursing is to approve nursing education programs in Minnesota. And due to a recent change that MNSCU has made in their policy regarding technical colleges, which have historically educated licensed practical nurses, and now will begin to be able to educate associate degree nursing, we expect another at least 20, between 20 and 25 additional programs that we will have to deal with for approval and monitoring. The board's budget is about $3.3 million, and yet our revenue collections are between $5 and $6 million. This equates to about $31.42 per licensee for operating costs. In a national survey conducted 2 years ago, and we were compared to other boards of nursing, and our operating cost is about $13 per licensee below the national average. So I give you that information because I want you to know how really efficient I believe that the board is and how what stewards the board has been of the revenue. Board revenues support much more than operating expenses. You heard about the Health Professional Services Program yesterday. That program costs the Board of Nursing about $700,000 a year in a biennium. In addition to that, we transfer monies to the Department of Health for monitoring of HIV, HBV, HCV licensees. We fund the volunteer health care provider malpractice insurance. shared costs for the administrative services unit, and of course statewide costs, indirect costs for services from other state agencies. All of those eventually have a trickle-down effect to the boards. As you might expect, those agencies raise their charges for services when they have to balance their budget, and that cost trickles down then to the boards, which interestingly have no place to trickle down beyond that. In fact, over $4 million was transferred in the last two biennia from the Board of Nursing Revenues to the Department of Health and to the Department of Human Services for scholarship and loan forgiveness programs. Our fees are $105 for an initial license and $85 for a renewal of license, and that's every 2 years. So that amounts to about $42.50 per licensee. We've done budget reductions over the last three biennia without raising fees. We've made changes to accommodate that. We've maximized technology through using e-licensing, electronic communications. We've become as paperless as we can. We've moved to electronic document management. We have eliminated certain services that we provide to our have provided to licensees in the past. The purpose of the Board of Nursing, like all of the other health-related licensing boards, is public safety. That's the mission of the board. And my concern is that the budget reductions or transfers to other programs are resulting in an erosion of those core services. Those services are licensure. That is that we assure the public to the best of our ability that the individuals who are licensed in Minnesota have the necessary education and competence to do so and the ethics to do so. We have noted in recent years an increase in fraud, and we've even dealt with cases with Homeland Security that have resulted in deportation. We do the nursing, as I said earlier, the nursing school's approval function, assuring the competence of the graduates of the programs. In Minnesota, we do that in an outcome-based manner. We focus on evaluation of nursing competencies and not on hours in the classroom or clinical or curriculum as in other states. We do advisement on nursing practice. We get approximately 150 calls a week from licensees or employers of nurses regarding the congruence of their education with their scope of practice and level of licensure. We work with emergency preparedness in the state and with healthcare reform. And finally, we discipline nurses who violate the law. As I told you before, last year we dealt with about 1,450 written jurisdictional complaints. They range from diversion of drugs to financial exploitation of patients to sexual misconduct and fraud and many other minor infractions. We've made, you may or may not have been noticing in the news, there's a recent focus on nursing boards' performance across the country, or rather maybe a lack thereof, I should say, especially in California and in Oregon. In fact, in California, the governor, per se, fired all of the Board of Nursing, and one of the reasons for that was the length of time to resolve complaints. In their case, it was over 3 years. In Minnesota, we're not that high, but the average is about 337 days. That's a concern to me, and it is a concern to the board. As a result, we've made very significant effort to identify what affects the process, such as bottlenecks in our system, redundant processes, backlog of documents from the AG. In the last budget process, the legislature increased our budget to add investigators and legal analysts so that we could reduce the backlog of documents that were overdue. We've established benchmarks and performance measures and are using Deming's model to change to continue to increase efficiency and efficacy of the work that we do. If a nurse needs to be out of practice or needs to have his or her practice monitored for the sake of public safety, we want to do it efficiently and we want to do it in a timely as possible manner. Which brings me to the reduction. $62,000 in the first fiscal year and in this fiscal year and $100,000 in the next fiscal year. The effect of that reduction will be a reduction of one senior investigator, which interestingly, the legislature funded most recently a reduction in the monies that we have for expert witnesses and board member reimbursement. We estimate that this will increase the loss of that investigator will increase the time to procure records approximately 30% or 40 days. It will increase the number of backlog of notices and orders to be drafted by approximately 25% and increase cycle time by about 27% or approximately 73 days. In effect, while it won't negate, it will certainly impact what we have been trying to accomplish, and that is to reduce the cycle time, to increase the efficiency of the work that we do and the efficacy of our programs which are directed at public protection. Again, I thank you, and I'm happy to answer any questions that the committee may have.
Oh, Representative Lane.
When California fired the Board of Nursing because they were ineffective in handling complaints, was part of their effectiveness due to the reduction in their capacity to serve the people because of their amount of money that they had to work with?
Madam Chair, Representative Lane. I think the best way I can answer your question is to tell you this, that in California, the number of licensed nurses is about 375,000, so certainly much larger than in Minnesota. They shared investigative staff they shared 40 investigators with 25 other licensing boards. While the Board of Medical Practice had all of their own investigators, the effect, of course, was that investigators weren't able to get to all of the cases. And since that occurrence, the department has hired 100 additional investigators. So obviously it was a human resource issue. I don't know about other processes or anything like that. That's just, you know, there's just that one piece that I'm aware of.
Thank you. Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Brecken, is it? You talked about the amount of time that it, so the California issue was about the amount of time that it took for them to investigate or come to resolution of a claim, and then you spoke to our state is 300 and something days and your concern. What if you were, you know, in a perfect world or in really, you know, running at high efficiency, how long would you expect for us to take to resolve an investigation or resolve a claim?
Madam Chair, Representative Hayden, therein lies the rub. At present time, we're working with the National Council of State Boards of Nursing in a program called CORE, or Commitment for Ongoing Regulatory Excellence, and which is some of the survey data that I cited. And what we are doing is looking at best practices across boards across the country, looking at higher performing boards and what are their processes and what are some of the statutory authorities that they have to be able to accomplish shorter cycle times. We have a couple of things going on right now in terms of benchmarking and performance, and one of the pilot studies that we have going on at the Minnesota Board is to deal with, focus specifically on drug diversion complaints, and the target is to resolve those complaints within 90 days. Mm-hmm. Part of that is based on the fact that the board meets every other month, so you need at least that overlap of time for the board to take its action. But we're doing some things in terms of, as I said, using Deming's model, in looking at our processes, looking at our bottlenecks, looking at where things are sort of slowing the process down to get toward that 90-day target for those kinds of cases. The staff and board have also established a target of within 2 years a 25% reduction in cycle time from the point of complaint coming in to final resolution of the case.
Madam Chair.
Representative Hayden.
So it sounds like you're doing really good work in understanding what your process is and prioritizing cases. It sounds like depending on different kind of cases, drug diversion, and I'm not absolutely sure what that is, but it sounds like that would be something you want to get on pretty quickly versus maybe other more ethical complaints that take a longer time. But can you speak to a little bit as to the reduction in what you would see in the budget and how that would affect it? I'm not sure that I heard you talk about, you know, bodies and boots on the ground, personnel, and those kinds of issues. It sounds like you're doing a wonderful job at becoming more efficient and looking at yourself. But can you speak to specifically the actual cuts and what they will do to your ability to do that?
Certainly. Madam Chair.
Ms. Bracken, briefly, and then we'll move on.
Mm-hmm. What I did cite for you was to accomplish that reduction, because of, again, the nature of our budgets being primarily, you know, the majority being staff and rent. I mean, those are our big items. The only way for us to accomplish reducing $100,000 in our budget is to look at reducing personnel. And in this case, we have identified that we would reduce one senior investigator. In addition to reducing our costs for expert witnesses for contested case hearings, that's the chunk. Certainly, we've taken it out of supplies and other areas too. But that's really where we'll accomplish it. We estimate that will again increase our cycle time by approximately. To obtain records by about 40 days or 30%, and cycle time, 73 days. So what we have been working toward reducing, this won't negate it, but it certainly will impact it.
Thank you. Just one question, and I know we're a little short of time, but I was just looking, you know, the money that our license fees go into includes such things as you mentioned, the HIV program at the Department of Health. Mm-hmm. Now, why is that coming out of the license fees of nurses? And that there's three or four different categories there. Just very briefly, if you can.
Sure, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, the HIV, HBV, HCV monitoring program at the Department of Health is for the purpose of monitoring licensees with those particular conditions. I think it's been in effect for a little over 10 years now. And the licensees that are included in that program are nurses, physicians, dentists, podiatrists, and one other. And I'm sorry, I can't think of what it is. We call them the blood boards. In effect, they are the boards that do, the licensees do invasive types of procedures and could be at risk for transmission of HIV, HBV, HCV to patients.
Okay, I understand. Do those other professions also pay out of their license fees? Okay.
Madam Chair, yes, they do. It's on a pro rata basis. There are, of course, because there are 105,000 nurses as compared to, say, 20,000 physicians or, you know, the like of dentists, the pro rata share to the Board of Nursing is greater than it is to any of the other boards.
All right. Thank you so much. Representative Lane, did you want to comment?
Yes, I would just make another comment that I learned that California is being sued, I'm not sure by whom, for taking health boards' funds and putting it in the general fund when they come from licensees and paying their fees for being licensed and taking that and turning it in basically a tax. And they're being sued for that. And I wonder if it came to a point in such as the Board of Nursing where they just didn't have enough money to operate and people became upset and said, you know, enough. We do these fees for the purpose of running this board, for the purpose of public safety, and it's being diverted into basically a hidden tax. Mm-hmm. And California is being sued for that.
Madam Chair, Representative Lane, it's actually Arizona that has the lawsuit, yes. And the lawsuit has been brought forward by the Nurses Association, the Medical Association, some of the professional associations. The suit is against the state for transferring as you said, dollars from licensure fees to the general fund. And while I've read the suit, the details are that's oversimplifying it, but that is essentially what it is.
Thank you. Representative Rosenthal?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the testifier, you sort of touched on this with Representative Hayden's question, but you go on to say that cases can't be followed up due to lack of legal counsel, and say that some will need to be dismissed or inappropriately resolved and delayed due to inability. Can you speak to what types of cases those are?
Madam Chair, Representative Rosenthal. What I have spoken to is the cycle times that I believe will be impacted, and the work that the board is trying to do to reduce that cycle time. I know that other testifiers yesterday spoke to maybe not doing some cases or, you know, taking longer to do them. I would expect that, as you might, that the board will focus on the most egregious cases. That's what we do now in the triage and prioritizing of cases, which is unfortunately one of the things that indeed causes some of the problems, because as more egregious cases come in, those that have been triaged lower sort of keep getting pushed down. And that's what we really wanted to go after some time ago, was to clean up all of that backlog, and thus we came to the legislature and did get funded for increased investigators and legal analysts. And I thank you for that, because the legal analysts that we hired, in fact, one started in August, it was in this last legislative session, essentially have removed the backlog in terms of documents. At one point, we had 150 documents we were waiting for from the Attorney General's office. And by that, I mean notices to licensees to appear before the board, or orders for disciplinary action. The monies that will reduce toward, you know, for expert witnesses will ultimately probably result in us not going forward with a particular contested case. To tell you what that case might be, I can't say, because, you know, those always depend. In as much as possible, we work with the licensees to get them engaged in a consent order. That is, between the licensee and the board, there is an agreement as to what the facts are and what the remedy will be, or what the disciplinary action will be. When we are unable to get to that point, to that type of a resolution, then we have to go to a contested case, which is is essentially a trial before an administrative law judge. That's when the expert witnesses come into place. So it would depend entirely upon what the situation was and what we could go forward with. I mean, once the dollars that we have allotted to that have been spent, we'll wait until the next cycle that we could hire expert witnesses. And they cost us about $450 to $500 an hour.
Oh. Okay. All right. Thank you. We have to move along. I think if there's more questions, please contact Ms. Brecken. These are
Thank
all good
you, Madam
questions
Chair
and
committee.
Good concerns. I'm going to ask a couple of folks to come down together. I think some of these, we're hearing a theme, you know, repeated theme, and it's really important that we were able to ask these questions. But I'm going to ask, I believe this is Randy Schneider from the Nursing Home Administration. How about if we also have from the Board of Psychology, Angelina Barnes in Physical Therapy. Why don't you come down and just join, and we're going to try to keep moving. Well, maybe I guess one more of you, and then we'll wait a second. Got two chairs there. Okay.
Madam Chair, I'm
just
going to
remind
ask
ourselves that we have to get through all of you. So go ahead, Mr. Snyder.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'll dispense with my written comments and just get to a very brief summary, and then stand for questions. Julie Vagsness is with us with ASU, and we're going to talk a little bit about ASU. I am the Executive Director for the Board of Nursing Home Administrators. That's a very small agency, but I also serve as the lead agency for the Administrative Services Unit. You've met Julie before. That is where we do all the coordinated back office functions to make our boards as efficient as they can be, the common business functions of accounting, of purchasing, of IT, of contracting, and HR. All of those are handled through the ASU department through Julie Vagsness. And she does have the voluntary health care program that we need to address today. Benha is a small agency, $200,000, 80% is salary and rent, 10% for meeting, for board meeting, to keep the public mission in front of the citizens. So we are limping by. I think your questions have always been, Representative Clark, how does this impact public safety? And you've heard. We are more or less in the customer service mode, and we will have to cut back on our customer service standards. ASU, I mentioned that, and we have a, in Benha, we have a 2.0 FTE. We're going to reduce that to 1.5. That's a significant cut, but that is what we will do. We understand the critical role you are in. Representative Lane, it is also the state of Missouri, and there are a few other states that are looking at this very same issue of taxing licenses and then transferring to other parts of state government. The Minnesota model of health licensing boards is considered a national model. We have a number of federal or national groups that point to Minnesota as being a model of efficiency the way we handle it. And I'll put that plug in and simply stand for, I should say that we last raised our fees in 1995, so we've been very efficient. It does sort of change your mentality when you've been saving paper and pencils and sticking things in your back files and then to see them be swept away. It does change your thinking on how prudent of steward you want to be, but I'm from central Minnesota and we have those standards. Use the back of an envelope if you have to. I'll stand for questions. I guess we'll leave it at that.
Thank you, Mr. Snyder. Any questions? Maybe just, I think you spoke that to the fact that this raises issues of public safety, and I think insofar as there are some things that you think we should know as a committee, would you please just put that in writing? We'd like to hear a little more about that. If it is, I think many of us know that our nursing homes are, we have a lot of people there, and there's a lot of concerns for a lot of Minnesotans. So thank you.
And Madam Chair, could I have Julie come in and just talk about the voluntary health care program very briefly?
Sure. Welcome back to the committee.
Thank you.
Ms. Agnes.
I'd like to just speak really quick on the Administrative Services Unit budget. Last session, we were able to add a few other line item accounts that we use for all of the boards. One of them is a legal cost account that gives us the ability to transfer funds to boards if a large contested case is upon them. And it just gives them another resource instead of having to go separately to the Legislative Advisory Commission for additional funds. And then we also had a retirement account that we tried to estimate how many retirees we would have between all of the boards, and we set up one accounting string. This budget cut will affect both of those line items and just reduces what we have available then to pay for retirement or pay for legal costs in the future. And then the last item is the Volunteer Healthcare Provider Program. This program was established in 2003, and we've struggled all along in the funding of this program. We never really know how many volunteers are going to come on board, and for some reason this last 6 months we've almost doubled our volunteers. We have over 42 volunteers in the program. I have another 8 applications sitting on my desk, and we only have funds for about 25 people to be volunteers under the program where we purchase their malpractice insurance. So by cutting this program by the 3%, not only does it put us farther back where we already are, we don't have sufficient funds. We're going to probably have to limit the number of applications that we have that people can submit into the program and try to triage and make sure that we're covering maybe those that are putting in the highest number of volunteer hours within their community in funding their thing. The other part that we'll be having to reduce is our operation budget, and that, of course, will be in our salaries because that's all we have. We don't have really any other costs associated with our staffing. We currently have 7.6 staff, and we'll need to cut 25 or 0.25 the first year and a 0.4 of that the second year. Any questions?
Any questions from committee members?
Just one very quick one. What is the average liability insurance cost for a volunteer?
Doctors is around $5,000. A dentist runs me about $1,500, and nurses around $500 a year.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you. Thank you for the opportunity this morning. I'm Angelina Barnes, the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Psychology. The Board of Psychology has 9.2 full-time employees and regulates approximately 3,600 licensed psychologists and licensed psychological practitioners. Our current license fee is $500, and the board's renewal cycle is biannual. Our renewal fee is also the same as our initial licensure fee, so our applicants and licensees pay $500 every 2 years. In addition to licensure, like the other health licensing boards, we process approximately 150 complaints per year on individuals within our jurisdiction. In fiscal year 2008, we had 240 open complaints. And in talking to the length of time that a complaint is processed, we have 56 open less than 3 months, 46 open less than 3 to 6 months, 60 open 6 to 12 months, and 78 complaints open over 1 year, and that's from fiscal year 2008. The greatest number of complaints that we see are alleged in the area of unprofessional conduct or conduct which has the potential to cause harm to the public. It includes failure to conform to the minimum standards of acceptable and prevailing practice. These violations are critical, and they include the psychologist's prohibition against engaging in sexual intercourse or physical intimacies with a client. So these are the predominant type of complaints that we are dealing with. With respect to the 3% reduction, it's a $16,000 reduction for our board in 2010 and a $24,000 reduction in 2011. In both 2010 and 2011, the board cuts will come in the area of full-time salaries, resulting in the cut of 0.35 FTE in 2010 and 0.31 FTE in 2011. The cut will impact the licensure unit. We currently have 4 vacant positions, 3 of which are in the licensure unit. It will result in delays in license issuance and application processing. The board is also having to consider diverting some of the staff from the complaint unit to the licensure unit and essentially stretching bodies wherever we can. The other areas of reduction under the 3% cut will be in overtime and out-of-state travel. The board is currently working towards online renewal and verification as its primary IT project. It's been delayed, and ultimately the cuts will trickle down to our IT projects. We don't have any dollars allocated in 2010 or 2011 for computer services. Dollars needed to cover these expenditures will be taken from full-time salaries. Database maintenance improvement is on hold and is at a baseline functionality. Data requests made to the public are now limited due to the current state of our database system, and no funds exist to remedy the deficiencies. Online renewal and verification services may also be delayed. Thank you for the opportunity. I'll stand for questions.
Questions from committee members? Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Madam Chair, to the testifier. So we just heard from the nursing board that they have really worked awfully hard to make sure that they had all of the online efficiencies, and they really are, sounds like they're running pretty smoothly. Can you talk about why you guys are behind and now we're kind of in this crunch, and so you can't kind of get ahead, and it sounds like your fees there's a lot of money that has to be paid to your fees. Can you just speak to that a little bit? That just stuck out to me.
I can. Representative, Madam Chair, we have 3,600 licensees, so while our fee is obviously higher than the nursing board, we have a significant lower number of licensees paying in those fees. As to the technology, we are currently entirely paper. We do take in all of our applications on paper and all of our renewals. Every process we go through is on paper currently. And I am new to the board as of August. I will say that there was not an investment in technology for our particular board. We do have a current level of investment into online renewal, so we're very close with that project. However, in the other areas, we just haven't had the funds to be able to devote it to improving that technology.
Madam Chair.
Thank you.
So, any further? And then the other thing, and I might have missed it, can you talk about the amount of money that you take in, and then how much you send out to other? Or do you have that same problem where you're sending money out to the general fund, or is all of your money just covering the cost to do your work?
Ms. Burns.
We don't fund other programs currently, so it is all board expenses for us, unlike the nursing board, who has funds diverted for other programs.
Representative Hayden, I think the difference is with the cut, you will be sending dollars out to the general fund.
Yes.
And remind us how much that is, please.
Approximately $40,000 between the two fiscal years.
So, Madam Chair, So I guess I would have to say that I'm concerned. I'm concerned not only that we're cutting your money, but I'm concerned about your efficiency. And I'm concerned about your process, and I'm concerned that you are closer to being more automated than you are, and that you're taking your applications by paper, and that that contributes significantly to maybe the impact of these cuts. And so I think that that, you know, and I kind of hate to do it, I'm not trying to take you to task, I know you're new, but I really think that that is something that we really maybe need to talk a little more about in terms of how do we become efficient. And I've heard the other groups come in and talk about their efficiencies and the models that they've done and the backroom services, and then I kind of hear you come in and say we're kind of doing the things that we did in the 1970s or the 1980s, and that I think is problematic, and we should probably have a real conversation. I know we don't have the time today to do so. Okay.
Thank you very much. I believe now physical therapy. Okay, and again, committee members, it looks like in order to not ask these people to come back a second time, we probably really want to ask you again to limit your comments so you can just bring, you can say, ditto, we have the same issue. Tell, give us certainly details that we should know. We're sending out this much, and it's really hurting us in this way. But let's try to get through at least our folks, and then maybe we can come back for some final questions. So we're going to kind of move a little faster here just so we don't leave any of the people off who've come twice now. So thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Stephanie Lunning. I'm the Executive Director for the Board of Physical Therapy. We have 3 full-time employees, 5,400 licensed physical therapists, physical therapist assistants, a $100 application fee, a $60 annual license fee. Our fees have not changed since 1994. We are looking at the governor's proposed budget reduction of $15,000, $6,000 for this year, $9,000 for the next biennium. We are one of the boards that is in a, I feel a little bit like survivor guilt here, in a little less pain right now, partly because of timing. We did change to IP phones recently, which cut some communication costs, and we also in 2 weeks will be rolling out our online initial applications. We've had online renewals for 8 years. And the thing I want to share with you is that the 7 small boards have leveraged our computer development very effectively. We use the same our personalized versions of the same database, the same online renewals and the online application that my board developed who is being given to the other boards. So with some tweaks, they'll be able to, at no, you know, very limited cost, also have the online initial applications. In terms of how this budget reduction would impact us, this biennium, it won't be a reduction in services or public safety. What we will be having to do is slow down our rulemaking process for continued competency rule enhancements. But otherwise, we are able to maintain what we're doing. So I will be available for questions or afterwards for questions.
And it looks like the dollars you're exporting is about $15,000?
Yes, $15,000.
Thank you very much. Okay, and the next is physical therapy. Stephanie, is that correct? Stephanie?
I'm sorry, what?
Physical therapy?
Yes.
You want to introduce yourself?
Committee members, my name is Ruth Brendel, and I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Board of Podiatric Medicine.
Got it. I was one back. Thank you. We just had physical therapy.
Yes. Looks like we're going quick enough then.
Yeah, that's great.
The board is comprised of 7 members, 5 are podiatrists, and 2 are public members. The board is staffed by a half-time position, which is me, having worked 8 hours over the weekend and 10 hours on Monday. Sometimes it doesn't seem like a part-time position. Mm. Our board is very similar to the rest of the health licensing boards. Our board revenues exceed our expenditures. Our revenues are $96,000. Our direct appropriation is $56,000. So combined with our indirect costs, we are allowed currently to spend 72.74% of what we currently collect. So $17,000 is taken from our board. What is unique to our board is we are running a surplus already this year. Upon applying for this position 4 months ago, when it was advertised, I was told that insurance benefits, albeit half, 50%, would be paid in the to go along with the position. Upon taking the position, I looked at the budget. There was no money there for health insurance, mm-hmm. so I chose not to take that I did not want to bust the budget the first year I was in a position. The other issue is, once again, our complaint resolution committee. We have $4,000 in our small budget for professional technical services, and I've had to inform my complaint resolution committee at the last two meetings that we cannot use that money for issues that they would like to delve into. I have a very committed board. Monday night, one of our doctors drove in with his scrubs on from a 325-mile round trip leaving from surgery. So I have a very committed board that when I told them that we couldn't spend that money, they don't understand when they're paying $600 fees how they cannot spend everything that they're putting into the board. A question yesterday was about teleconferencing, if that would save us any money. When I was hired, the board did use teleconferencing. There are fees that go with that. But when my complaint resolution committee comes together, they're oftentimes looking at hundreds of x-rays on complaints, and so it would make it very difficult to do more teleconferencing. With that, I stand for any questions.
Thank you. That was very efficient, and you hit some important points. I appreciate that. Any questions? All right. Social work, then. Kate?
Yes.
Zachary Pate, is that right?
Yes, that is, Madam Chair.
Welcome
thank you very
committee.
Much. Good morning.
And then can I just invite the family ombudsperson to come down? I think we're going to have a chance to get to you, too. Yeah. You can come on down and be ready at the table. Go ahead. I'm sorry. Just
that's just fine.
Just cutting minutes.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Kate Zacherpate. I'm the Executive Director of the Board of Social Work, and I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you this morning about the impact of the governor's proposed budget. I will try to keep my remarks very brief. I do want to provide, though, just a little bit of background to set the context. The Board of Social Work has existed since 1989. Core public functions, as you've heard before from the other boards, we license social workers who meet standards, and we also work to resolve complaints that are submitted by citizens. Fee-supported, no general fund dollars. The Board of Social Work regulates approximately 11,000 social workers in the state. We have seen a gradual increase of 9% in our licensee pool over the last 10 years. We process 1,200 new license applications a year, 425 renewals per month, and approximately 120 new complaints per year. And again, we've seen an increase in our complaints of about 10% over the last biennium. The Board of Social Work has moved towards being paperless. We have done online applications and renewals since about 2002, and our utilization rate is at approximately 85%. Our licensing fees, there have been questions about that. We have four different licenses, a bachelor's, a master's, two independent licenses, and the fees are $81, $144, $216, and $238, respectively, for a 24-month period, with application fees being $45. And we also have a staff complement of 10.6. We have a 15-person board. So that's sort of to set the context. I came before you last session and requested that the legislature approve a 10% fee decrease, which we were very excited about, and that was enacted. So we have been for years trying to maintain and reduce our expenditures. The impact of the 3% transfer of our operational funds in the proposed governor's budget is much like many of the other boards that you have heard from. The difference with the Board of Social Work, though, is that luckily, at this point in time, we are not needing to make any reductions in staffing and salaries. And I'm sort of crossing my fingers about that, but currently we think we can get by without that. The cuts to the Board of Social Work for both fiscal years total $46,000, $18,000 in FY10, $28,000 in FY11. So the impact, the negative impact for the Board of Social Work is more along the line of the complaint resolution process that you've been hearing about, delays in being able to resolve complaints, needing to triage, We are considering eliminating one of our board meetings. We have six per year, eliminating a board meeting in FY11, which would, again, lengthen the resolution time for our complaints. Again, we will be reducing equipment costs, not purchasing computers, and so we might not be as up-to-date with our technology as we would like to be. In-state travel, we will be reducing presentations to colleges and universities, and perhaps some of the staffing that we do at national conferences to get the word out about the board and our standards. Those are probably the highlights. It's a very quick summary. Again, I think the biggest impact for the Board of Social Work will be in the line of being able to maintain what we have currently, which is a pretty good complaint resolution turnaround time. So that will be impacted. And I would stand for any questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, I think we're going to, unless there's any urgent questions, it doesn't look like it, we'll go on to Ms. Hill. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Ann Hill. I'm with the Office of Ombudspersons for Families. There's also the other three ombudsmen here. There's Don Blanchard, there's Muriel Gubasta, and Bao Nin Chu. I have a copy of our budget here and our appropriation. Unlike the other boards, we rely on a general fund appropriation in order to function. We get, in the past, we've gotten $265,000 direct appropriation, and with the governor's recommendation of a 3% reduction, that will take our appropriation down $4,000 to $261,000. Now, how this will affect us is just in this way. The four of us are all paid out of that formerly $265,000. And it doesn't cover our four salaries. We do get a direct appropriation from DHS of $92,000. So we, in the past, have always used a portion of that $94,000. In this case, this year, we'll be using $41,000 of the $92,000 to cover the four salaries. And we do have a staff person who comes in twice a week, up to 16 hours a week, to take care of some of the administrative duties, so we can tend to the issues of caring for the complaints of children and families involved in the child protection system, and responding to counties and states' requests for us to be a part of policy groups and others. So this year, and because we've been so frugal with our money, we've been able to carry over funds over the years and have enough money of in carryover to take care of our operating expenses. But this, where we're at today, is in a good place. But over the next few years, we will see a reduction in that carryover, which makes sense. And in which case, we're beginning to make some decisions about where we're renting space, how we can bring ourselves up to the 21st century with respect to technology. We've been in the dialogue with OET and are getting ourselves upgraded to state standards with respect to technology, computer, our other communication services, and we've also eliminated any out-of-state travel. We've, in addition to that, employee development is one of the areas where we will no longer be able to accommodate any one of us to do any improvements that way. So as it stands today, the $4,000 will not affect any specific layoffs, but we are looking in 2012, we've got some serious issues to contend with, and we're working with our financial management reporting right now, our EBO, and with admin, seeing if we can reduce some of these costs. It's important for an agency like ours, who deals with complaints of the nature of child protection, it gets to be pretty complicated because many times in our states and in most states, child welfare laws are sometimes and policies are sometimes responding to federal requirements, and there have been two significant federal legislations that are causing an increase in requests for our intervention. Those two have been the Adam Walsh Act and Promoting Safe Family. The Adam Walsh Act is now requires more restriction with respect to licensing homes and licensing relatives to take children in the home. As a result of that, Minnesota had been doing a fairly good job in licensing families to take children who are in child protection, but this new federal legislation is causing some conflict. In addition to that, Promoting Safe Families Act, on the contrary, is saying that states have to make more of a diligent effort to place children with relatives. So we are constantly in conflict and hearing complaints from county people and from families about how we can resolve these issues. That's just to give you kind of a general idea of some of the challenges that we are facing. I'm more than willing to take any questions. I know you don't have our agency profile, but that will be coming to you directly to you, representative and members of the staff, through email.
Thank you very much. I think the other three members of your team are here. Is that right? Do you want to
just
stand
are.
So we can mm-hmm. recognize you?
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Really appreciate your being here today. And we'll wait for any other questions to the end, but
okay.
If you can just hang around for a few more minutes. Appreciate that you came. I know you're doing really important work, and I do want to indicate if you have anything to indicate about threats to the public safety from the cuts, please let us know. I didn't hear that from what you said, but if there are some, it would be helpful to know.
Yes, we will send that to you in written document form so you can get it to all the members.
Thank you so much, Ms. Hill.
Sure.
Then,
thank you.
Disability Council, do we have Joan Wilshire and...
Is that right? Welcome to the committee. And Roberta. Is next. Yeah, you're welcome to come sit at the table, Roberta, when we get to you.
Good morning.
Welcome to the committee.
Good morning. My name is Joan Wilshire. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota State Council on Disability. And yes, I'll share with Roberta. I'm going to make mine real quick since we're running out of time. Quickly, the State Council on Disability, in a nutshell, we were created in 1973 as an advisory entity on disability issues to the governor, legislature, state agencies, and the public. We have about 4.6 staff. We just got reduced one staff because they moved to another agency, so we are now looking for another one. We receive just a little under $524,000 a year in state appropriations. And what I'm handing out to you right now is a brief overview, a synopsis of last fiscal year of some of our accomplishments, things we do. And the issues that we work on, in a nutshell, range from building code and accessibility, disability parking, emergency preparedness and planning, employment rights and accommodations, transportation rights, as well as policy issues there, relocating people out of nursing homes, aging issues, and assistive technology. All within that, we handle technical assistance calls as well as trainings within those areas. So when looking at the governor's budget, he's looking to reduce our budget 3%, so roughly $16,000 this particular fiscal year and then the upcoming fiscal year as well. What we are planning to do is I can do my job the best with my agency with staff. I'm going to be reducing basically all my IT needs, information technology obligations. Computers can't answer the phone and go to conferences, and go to meetings, and represent the disability community. So I'm looking to keep the staff as well invested as possible. And so right now we're looking at reducing all of our IT obligations and also some of the areas of professional technical assistance contracts. We use those contracts to hire out for training. So what that may impact is training that we deliver to state agencies, which could imply that the state could be at risk for compliance issues regarding ADA violations and et cetera down the road. So there are implications not so much for our agency in particular, but the state as a whole as we look at it going down the road. I think that's it as a real short analogy. Like I say, the handout will answer a lot of your questions, and I'm here to answer any right now.
Okay, thank you so much. If you can just maybe just stay there for a minute. We're going to go over to the Roberta at the Office of Ombudsman for Health and Developmental Disabilities. And welcome. Thanks for coming back.
Good morning, Chairman, member of the committees. My name is Roberta Opheim. I'm the Ombudsman for Mental Health and Developmental Disabilities for the state of Minnesota. And we're a small agency, not dissimilar to the boards, except that we are totally general fund appropriated and do not have these revenue streams. The only revenue stream that we generate is that we fill out the federal financial participation documents, but that to recapture some federal funds, but those funds do not come to us. They go directly to the general fund. So, but the work qualifies for it. When we were asked what options we would have within our budget to take 3% this year and 3% next year, we responded that for 2010, the agency would hold back $31,429, and that would be taken totally out of staffing. And for the second year of the biennium, we'll hold back $49,650, 44 of which will come from staffing, and $5,000 will then be held back from the travel. And when I indicate travel, I want to make it clear this is not out-of-state travel. This is travel necessary for my staff to go and meet with many of the vulnerable clients who are not able to come and meet with us, or to attend the meetings, or to advocate on their behalf in those meetings. So with that, we had a position that is sitting empty because of a leave of absence, and that's the position we will not fill. So with that, I would respond to questions.
Thank you. And how big is your staff? With that empty position, how many?
Well, right now we have, I believe, 17 and a half full-time position, 17 and a half FTEs, 16 full-time, 1.5 part-time. And they include the regional staff that go out and meet with clients and try to resolve their complex problems with the system. Then we have individuals who do the death and serious injury reviews. We have a 5-member medical review subcommittee that reviews those, but they're unpaid appointees.
Okay. Thank you very much. Now, just wait there for just a second. Did the person from the medical board come? Medical practices? Mr. Leach? Okay, if not, we might just have that another day. Are there any questions for either of these two witnesses or any of the others that committee members have? Representative Saylor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this question is for both of you and also for the Family Ombudsman. As I understand, you are the two boards that are not co-located with the rest of them, and I'm just wondering what led to that. Why are you not in the same building where you can share IT possibilities and other, you know, efficiencies of running an office with the other boards? There may be a reason. I don't know what it is, but I would just like to have you address that, please.
I can address that for you, because the boards that operate, they have different kind of accounting systems, revenue streams, reserve funds, and the functions that they perform are significantly different than the functions we perform. I've been involved since 1990s on a discussion of co-location of projects for small agencies, where we'd have an ombudsman center. They could be independent agencies for the populations they serve. We asked for a one-time budget of about $250,000 to bring them together, and then share payroll processing and all of that. The legislature declined that. I probably have 5 studies on efficiency of bringing ombudsman functions close together. You know, ombudsmen are direct service. Licensing does the licensing. And then you have your policy boards. And I think that there's some subtleties that speak to co-location, but not just because you're small, co-location isn't always appropriate. But targeted appropriation based on your function, similarity, training, and opportunities, we think is a very important thing. I sublet space to the long-term care ombudsman for a number of years so that they would appear to be independent of the Department of Human Services. Then when they built the Anderson Building to protect space allocations in the building, they were pulled back in, except that I then couldn't get out of the lease for their space, but they quit paying their part of the lease for the space. So, you know, there are issues related to, but we are very open to co-locating, but it has to make sense for the populations we serve and the function that we do, not just geographic location.
Thank you. Ms. Hill, did you want to comment?
Madam Chair, yes. Madam Chair, members of the committees, I would just like to add that we were, the Office of Ombudsperson was a part of that dialogue with the Ombudsman for Mental Health and Retardation. We published a report. We asked for the money, and nothing happened. We've since had some more informal dialogues, and it just hasn't worked out. Our small agency would need money to move, even though we're going to have to make some decisions here really, really soon. I don't know if we could afford to rent space in a building like Roberta's in right now, but we would entertain the thought if it could. We definitely would if it could save us money. And we even looked at the health board, but that wasn't going to work for us. They didn't have the space, and so we've actively looked into this and worked with other ombuds offices to try to resolve this.
Thank you. We're going to have to wrap up.
Okay. I was just going to say, we've often proposed that as we build a new DHS, a new health, that there ought to be one building that's like a small business incubator that's for small agencies, and then they buy the services they need, have the interview rooms and the conference rooms and the training rooms. But that never goes anywhere.
Well, why don't you see if there's members of this committee at some point that might be interested in looking at that. So I invite you to do that. I did want to just make one comment to the Council on Disability. When you mentioned the issue of whether or not the state might get out of compliance, I'd really be interested, and there's really not probably time for it now, but I'd be interested if you see some areas where that is a threat. And because I know that that would be costly to the state. And so if you have some comments about that, maybe if you could put them in writing, it would be very helpful. I know that with all of the issues that have been going on recently around persons with disabilities whose medical care is being threatened right now, I'm guessing that you might get really busy with some of those direct service or complaint issues too. So I wanted to just say that I think the work you do is really important. Each of you, the work you do is incredibly important. You make the state laws function in the way they should. So I want to thank you. And we're just want a couple things more to the committee members. We did have a letter from Dr. King from the Board on Veterinary Medicine, who was not able to be here. And I wanted to just draw that to your attention. Dr. King makes some of the same points. And I think we'll try to see if we can hear from the Medical Practice Board, you know, at another time. I don't want to leave them out. We have the minutes from our previous meeting, March 2nd. Representative Bly, did you want to move those?
Yes, I'd move those.
Okay, Representative Bly moves the minutes from March 2nd to 2010. Any discussion? If not, all those in favor of approving the minutes signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails, and the minutes are approved and adopted. The committee is adjourned. Thank you.